American Cassette Ministries welcomes you to an hour of delightful learning with noted author, lecturer, and physician, Dr. Agatha Thrash. Her topic is Fascinating Facts About Sugar, Coffee, Chocolate, and Fermented Foods.
All right, the first topic is that of sugar. Sugar is a topic that I do campaign on. I feel that sugar is more injurious to us when taken in large quantity than is most any other food that we can take, maybe with the possible exception of fats. When we take fats in too large a quantity, that represents quite a tax on the body. And we do have a lot of different systems that are abnormally affected by sugars and fats and other concentrated elements. We have in our book called Nutrition for Vegetarians a table that I would like to tell you about. On page 40 in this book, you will find a table of the effects of sugar on white blood cells. The way the experiment was set up at the university where it was done was that a sample of blood was taken from an arm vein. Then the blood was anticoagulated so that it could be spun down, red blood cells at the bottom and white blood cells at the interface between the plasma and the red blood cells. Then these white blood cells were just sucked out with a pipette or a medicine dropper and placed in a shallow dish depression called a wet chamber, a moist chamber. Somewhat the same size as a glass slide. Then into this chamber with the white blood cells in it was introduced some kind of germ which white blood cells enjoy very much, such as pneumococci or streptococci, germs that attract very easily the white blood cell. It was found at the end of an incubation period of 30 minutes at 98.6 degrees that the white blood cells had an average of 14 germs in each white blood cell. Now that's quite a formidable army if you think about it, that each one of your soldiers could dispatch 14 of the enemy every 30 minutes. That's quite a display of strength. This is what our white blood cells can normally do. But if they gave the person 6 teaspoons full of sugar within an hour or two before drawing the blood, they found a 25% reduction in the quantity of germs that the white blood cell could take up. Instead of taking up 14, they only took up 10. If the person had been given 12 teaspoons of sugar, then the white blood cells only took up 5.5. 18 teaspoons full, only 2. And 24 teaspoons full, only 1. Now what we see here in the white blood cells, we might think would happen in all the other cells of the body. Could this happen in bones, in liver, in intestinal tract, in brain and in other cells? And the answer is yes, in all these cells, in our lymph glands and liver and spleen, all of these places do react negatively to our taking so much sugar. Now let's discuss what happens in the brain. If we check the behavior of individuals who take a lot of sugar, we find that many people react adversely to a load of sugar. Some psychologists have been studying criminal behavior in young men, young incarcerated criminals. In one prison, the researchers discovered that if the prisoners had sugary junk foods removed from their diet, that the next 3 months they had an 82% reduction in assaults, a 77% reduction in theft, a 65% reduction in malicious horseplay, and a 55% reduction in refusal to obey orders. Now those of you who have to do with the training of children will be very interested in those statistics. I was in North Carolina a few months ago and began my campaign against sugar, as I have just done with you. And a man stood up in the back and said, "May I say something to the group?" And I said, "Indeed, go right ahead." He said, "My name is Mr. Carter. I am the principal of the Calvary Baptist Christian School. 2 years ago, we had 100 students, and we were having such disciplinary problems in the school that I felt that I was dealing with a group of heathen, not with Christians. And I was lying in bed one night after one of my teachers had resigned because of all the disciplinary problems in the school. And I was just thinking about this problem and praying about it, wondering why a Christian school would have so many disciplinary problems. And almost as if a bolt of lightning came out of the blue, I felt that I had the answer. Next morning, I called a teacher's meeting. That afternoon, when the teachers gathered together, I said, "We're having a change in policy in this school. From now on, no child can attend this school who uses white sugar, not in the home, not away from home. No child can attend this school who watches television, not at home, nor anywhere else." He said the first thing that happened was a 50% reduction in enrollment. He said, the next thing that happened was that we stopped having disciplinary problems. And about that point, he looked up at me and said, "Dr. Thrash, we don't have any disciplinary problems in the school now." And I said, "You mean you have 50 students and you don't have any disciplinary problems?" He said, "Well, we have more students than 50 now, but the answer is yes, we do not have any disciplinary problems now." And I was amazed. 50 students all together and no disciplinary problems. I think that if parents and teachers would take a cue from this teacher and from certain psychologists who are working in the penal institutions, I believe that they could find some great benefit from what these researchers have found. Personally, I would like to see all of the vending machines removed from schools. I would like to see any kind of bazaar or fundraising activity not involve the sale of sweet things. I would like to see parents understand that spending money for children should have a very strict accounting, and that a child, although he is given money, that it be given for specific needs and not to spend as they would like to on junk foods. It is perfectly fine for a child to be taught how to handle his own money, but he should have certain specific needs that he spend those funds for, and a very strict accounting be made of that, and an audit by the parent be made once a month. That should be just as businesslike as if he were running a business. He is running a business, and he should have to account for all of the expenditures of his money, and that should not be for junk foods. If the child can spend his money for junk foods, the parent is going to have to spend his money for the doctor bills that will correct those, and dental bills that will correct the ill effects in the health that have resulted from the child's not understanding how to spend his money. Now the next thing that I would like to cover, I wish I had more time for sugar, but I'd like to go on to my next topic, which is coffee. Caffeinated beverages have been mentioned several times here at this seminar, and I would like to bring some of the research papers that I would like to add to the reinforce what has already been said, and hopefully to help you to reduce the sale of this improper item. We have heard a good bit also about tobacco in some of the lectures. Tobacco is, well, let's put it this way. Tobacco underlies most ill health, or much of the ill health in this country. There is no disease that is not adversely affected by smoking. And smoking can cause disease of any organ of the body, from hair and skin to the most internal of the organs. It is a very insidious protoplasmic poison. It causes mutations in cells and can injure every cell it touches. Same thing is true with the alcoholic beverages. These are protoplasmic poisons and, of course, injure every cell they touch. Now, there are some poisons that are poisonous only in large quantities, but there are other poisons that are poison in any quantity. Oxygen is one of the former. Oxygen is a poison only when we get it in large quantities. Sugar is a poison only when we get it in large quantities. Water is a poison only when we get it in large quantities. And yes, water also can intoxicate you. You can get double vision, nausea and vomiting, sweating, a sense of malaise and fainting from water intoxication. Fortunately, it's a very rare disorder and usually occurs only in those who are either psychotic or in children whose relatives have been too vigorous in the giving of enemas. But alcohol is a poison in any quantity. Caffeine is a poison in any quantity. Nicotine is a poison in any quantity. If you get it in small quantity, it's a small poison. If you get it in large quantity, it's a larger poison. And, of course, any of these can be fatal if taken in very large quantities. Here, from the Journal of Abnormal Psychology for 1984, we have an article that the caffeinated beverages cause anxiety, hostility, and depression. If you suffer from any of those, you should look carefully to your use of the caffeinated beverages or the brown drinks. Even when they are decaffeinated, they still have poisonous substances that can injure the body. Here is one that comes from the Journal of the National Cancer Institute for May 1984, showing that caffeine consumption and fibrocystic breast disease are related. Now, you will see in both the lay as well as the medical literature an on-again, off-again sort of thing with this subject. 1 month you will see a notice that indicates that the drinking of the caffeinated beverages causes fibrocystic disease of the breast. The next month you will see another article that indicates that the very reverse is true, that taking the caffeinated beverages actually protects you against fibrocystic disease of the breast. But I believe the first. I believe that these substances do increase one's risk of cancer and that they do increase one's risk of getting the fibrocystic breast disease. Here is one on coffee consumption, and ovarian cancer. This came out in the International Journal of Cancer for 1981. If a woman drinks 2 cups of coffee per day, she increases her risk of cancer of the ovaries by 2.2 times. Here is one from the Journal of Nutrition for April 1982. This was done on animals. It shows that coffee consumption in the mother during pregnancy presents subsequent abnormalities in the offspring. These abnormalities are such things as learning disorders, where they cannot be taught how to walk a maze or how they cannot be anticipated to behave in a normal fashion. Males may attack females, or males may attack young, something that a normal male will never do. A normal male rat and other male animals will not attack females and young. Now, the females will attack both other females and young under certain provocations, but not usually so with males among animals. But if the mother was given caffeinated beverage during pregnancy, they have these what we might call rat crimes. This is antisocial behavior in animals. My next topic is that of spices. Spices such as ginger, cinnamon, nutmeg, cloves, and the like, black pepper and red pepper. These contain substances that are known to be both cancer-producing and mutagenic. Now, mutagenic means that there is a permanent alteration in the chromosomal structure of the cell. This alteration makes it so that the cell cannot reproduce itself as its forebears have done. And consequently, we build into the race a permanent genetic change. This is one form of genocide along this particular cell line. If we give some kind of labeled caffeine or methylxanthine, like theobromine and theophylline, to a pregnant animal, such as a mouse or a rat, then when the little rat pups are born, if their gonads, the testes and ovaries, are checked, we can find the radio-labeled caffeine in their gonads, meaning that they have taken up the caffeine selectively in the gonads. Now, when we study what is going on there, it is discovered that adenine and caffeine are very close together chemically. And caffeine can be incorporated into DNA in place of adenine if caffeine is available. From then on, if caffeine is available, that cell will selectively take caffeine in the reproduction of itself, the replication of itself. That also is a weakening of the structure, the genetic structure of the cell. My recommendation is that spices and coffee and tea and colas and chocolate not be taken by any person as long as they are before or in the childbearing age. Now, you can do what you would wish to do afterward, but once you are out of the childbearing age, you are right in the cancer age. And if you are as I am, I would certainly not want anything. I certainly don't want to have anything to happen to my chromosomes in the cancer age. So, as well as I can see, these substances really don't have a good time when they can be taken by a human. One word about chocolate. Chocolate suffers from all of the problems that the caffeinated beverages suffer from. It also suffers from another that most of the caffeinated beverages don't suffer from, and that is the allowance of insect parts in the chocolate material itself. And if you will get the government specifications for chocolate, you will probably feel a little revolted after you have read them at how much is allowable in chocolate. Chocolate is a little bit higher than most of the other unpleasant to think about things so far as insect parts and droppings and the like are concerned, animal droppings. So far as the cleanliness of chocolate is concerned, because of its primary manufacturing stage, not the final ones as they are done in this country, but their primary manufacturing stage does incorporate quite a lot of animal products in the chocolate. You cannot be a total vegetarian and eat chocolate. One word about orange juice. It has been noted that various juices may have some sugar added to them, and the government does not require a labeling. Now, the reason for that, as with orange juice, the government defines how much carbohydrate is present in the juice. Then, if the carbohydrate level does not naturally meet that level, then the manufacturer can add to the product a sufficient quantity of sugar. Just plain sucrose or table sugar can add enough to bring the carbohydrate level up to a certain predetermined level, the legal level, and still use no sugar added to his label because of the fact that he has not added more than the law allows to adjust the carbohydrate level. That, of course, to people who are sugar intolerant, makes orange juice one of the sensitivity substances. Orange juice of itself, or oranges of themselves, represent a fair source of allergenic substances for a fairly large population segment in America. It is the number 3 item on the list of the top 10 food groups causing sensitivities. One of the reasons why orange juice can be so sensitivity producing is because of the added sugar. Another reason why orange juice is addicting is not just because of its own allergy producing potential, but also because of the sugar that may be contained within it that also causes the person to have an allergenic response. With orange juice, and as with other juices, you do not know when the fruit grew on the tree. It may be last year or last decade. The manufacturer holds the concentrate until the market is correct, and if they have a bumper crop 1 year, they simply hold the concentrate for years, if necessary, until the market is correct, and then it is readjusted and sold. So the best juice that you can get from oranges is that you squeeze yourself. A word about fermented foods. My orientation, having had some training in a germ-free laboratory, is that the less we can make our environment associated with germs, the better it is. We speak of the friendly bacteria, but actually there are just bacteria that are less our enemies than others. But all bacteria may be, in some degree, toxic to us. And the more we have of these, the greater the likelihood we may have of having some adverse reaction. Let me mention a couple of foods that I would particularly question. One is that of cheese. Of course, with cheese, we have several byproducts of the fermentation process that can be directly injurious to the human body. Some of the amines that are produced are, of course, available to unite with nitrites and nitrates to form nitrosamines. These are among the most intensely cancer-producing agents that we know. Another substance is that of the fermented soy sauces. Soy sauce, the way that it is classically made, is by a long process of fermentation. During this process, as with cheese, the soy bean can get a lot of mold growing on the ferment. And this substance, the molds, then can make for us aflatoxins and other toxins that are also cancer-producing. If you use soy sauce, use a kind of soy sauce that does not have a fermentation process as a part of its manufacturing. Next question is that of why be a vegetarian? I'd like to discuss that in a little bit of detail. There are people who are vegetarians the world over. In some places, people are vegetarians for cosmetic reasons. This would include entertainers, people who would like to show their aging as little as possible, since aging tends to be decelerated in vegetarians. Those who make their livings by their faces like the fact that people who are vegetarians tend to show their age less readily. They also tend to be more nimble of joint, and they tend to be lighter in weight with a great deal greater ease. So these things may be helpful to the person who is making his living in this way. A second reason why people are vegetarians the world over is for religious reasons. This would include Indians in India who believe in the transmigration of the soul and who for religious reasons do not want animals to be killed. That would include also members of the vegan society. The vegans, for humanitarian reasons and for compassion for animals, will not allow any animal to be used to supply their food, and in this I am very sympathetic. And they believe that every animal has his own right to live. So they will not even keep bees for the use of man. These individuals, for what we might call religious reasons, do not use animal products. Then for economic reasons, there are large numbers of people the world over who do not use any animal products. Personally, I like that about the vegetarian diet. The month that we became vegetarians in our home, we cut our food bill to 60% of what it had been before. We were very happy with that. Then when we cut out milk and eggs and cheese about 2.5 years later, we cut our food budget about 10% below that. So we have enjoyed the greater funds that we have for other pursuits than that of what we put on the table. Not that we skimp on what we put on the table. We're very careful with our meals, and I feel that people everywhere should be. But once we have made our decision as to what we will eat, then we sit down, eat with thanksgiving, and we do not think that we're going to be deficient or that what we're going to eat is going to hurt us. And I would like to present this as a principle of nutrition. And that is this: if you think your food will hurt you, be assured that it will. But if you sit down and eat with a free spirit and a glad heart, and with thanksgiving to our Creator for that that He has provided for our needs, it is much less likely that it will give you any kind of problem. It is also a much greater likelihood that your body will be able to digest and assimilate those nutrients that you have in your food. Now, the reason that we became vegetarians is the last reason, and that is the last reason that I will give you why people are vegetarians, and that is for health reasons. If you study the health reasons for being vegetarians, you will find there are many different reasons for health to be vegetarians. I believe I told you this morning that heart disease, did I not tell you this morning that heart disease is less in vegetarians? Maybe I didn't. In meat-eating Americans, the heart attack rate is 56%. But in those Americans who are what we might call vegetarians, that is, ovo-lacto-vegetarians, that is, who use milk and eggs but no flesh foods, these people have a 39% mortality rate from heart attacks. Now, those who are total vegetarians, that is, no animal products of any kind except for honey, these individuals have a mortality rate of 14% from heart attacks. With cancer, the spread is the same. For meat-eating Americans, 25%. For ovo-lacto-vegetarians, 15%. For the total vegetarians, less than 9%.
Once again, here is Dr. Agatha Thrash.
With cancer, the spread is the same. For meat-eating Americans, 25%. For ovo-lacto-vegetarians, 15%. For the total vegetarians, less than 9%. So I feel that what we can provide in the way of good counsel for people today as physicians is to aim in the direction of being a total vegetarian. Start where you are and go that way every time you have the opportunity. There are times when people who are vegetarians are criticized for their lack of vitamin B12 in the diet. It is true that the major B12 that human beings get is from animal foods. Now, this would include such things as meat and milk. Cheese may have a lessened amount. B12, however, is needed in far less quantity by people who are vegetarians. And the more strict you are with your vegetarian routine, the less vitamin B12 you need. As an example, if you take the level of B12 in a person who is a meat-eating individual, and I will just give you figures and not quantities of types of measuring quantities, but if you take a meat-eating individual, His B12 level will probably be somewhere between 500 and 600. If you take the B12 level of an ovo-lacto-vegetarian, his B12 level will probably be between 200 and 300. If you take the B12 level of a total vegetarian, if he has been a total vegetarian for many years, his B12 level is likely to be between 50 and 100. He is functioning perfectly well. Let's give each one of these three a loading dose of B12. Let's say 10,000 times the minimum daily requirement. That would be 1 milligram. Each one of these is given the same dose. We would say, just by thinking about it, that the total vegetarian would have tissues that were starved for B12. And even though he might be functioning all right, we could still suspect that his tissues would be needing B12 because of his low blood level. But let's take their blood levels a week later, or 2 or 3 weeks later. We will find that the meat-eating individual has increased his level by maybe to 1,000 or to 1,500. The ovo-lacto-vegetarian may have increased his level to 500 or 700. But the total vegetarian will hardly have flickered his B12 level. He might have gone up to 110 or 125, but he shows no indication that he was starved at all for B12. But if the total vegetarian is worried about his B12 level, I recommend that he go down to the drugstore and get a little B12 and just take a bit. He doesn't have to use some kind of product that he might fear would give him a dreaded disease just to get his B12. There are many other ways to get B12 than that. Now, if you are a vegetarian, or even if you're not, I'd like for you to do a little experiment right now to test your own nervous system to see how avidly your nervous system responds to your commands. Just take your hand like this and touch your thumb to your fingers as fast as you can go. Now, if you cannot do that fast, if you have to think about each action and maybe pause and with a good deal of clumsiness go from one to the other and have a little insecurity about what you're going to do, that represents a non-intact central nervous system. And it could be a B12 deficiency. And if you are in a position to get a B12 deficiency, you might consider that. Now, another one, if you would like to join me in this, you can just stand to your feet and just stand on one foot. Now, the average American cannot stand on one foot for very long. He usually cannot stand on one foot for a whole minute without having some kind of balance problem. Now, while you're standing on one foot, after you've done it for a whole minute, then take the heel of the other foot and just put that under the knee of the foot that you're standing on. And then slide your knee, your heel, right down to your ankle. And see how you can do that. Now, if you can do all three of those tests easily and with accuracy, it's highly unlikely that you have a B12 deficiency. You may be seated. Now, a word to those who tend to be hyperactive. You will notice if you are around vegetarian people very much, you will notice that they tend to be calm. They are not excitable and hyperactive, as many Americans are, because of the fact that a vegetarian diet is a calming diet. It does not irritate the nervous system. Not only that, a vegetarian diet does not cause one to accumulate waste products in the blood, and therefore the BUN, the blood urea nitrogen, is likely to be much lower. The uric acid will be lower. The cholesterol will be lower. Usually the sodium and the chloride will be lower. And these nutrients and waste products, which are lower in the blood, are not irritating the nervous system. Consequently, These people are calm. Children are calm. They're easy to discipline. If you see a group of children in a classroom who are total vegetarians, you do not hear the buzz of excitement, the hyperactivity, the dropped pens and pencils and books. And on the playground, you do not hear frenzied screaming and screeching. But if you put these children through an endurance exercise of some kind, you will find that the total vegetarian child will outlast, in an endurance performance test, the meat-eating child by about 10 to 1. A very easy test that you can do is a simple arm-raising test. This is for endurance. The person who is a meat-eating individual will get so tired of doing an arm-raising test, once after the other, that after about 200 times, he will decide that he just doesn't want to do that anymore. But the average vegetarian can continue that arm-raising test without any difficulty for 1,000 times or even more. And such an individual generally will demonstrate the fact that his endurance is much greater. In Olympic trainees who are practicing for their Olympic finals, they find that a total vegetarian diet is quite adequate, in fact preferable in many instances, especially for either endurance or for a burst of energy, than is the diet that contains meat. Many Olympic trainees select a total vegetarian diet. We have had many marathon runners who have eaten in our educational vegetarian restaurant in Columbus, Georgia, who have told us how much better they can run marathons on a vegetarian diet. Now, intelligence in children who are vegetarians does not fall behind that of others. There is very good evidence that vegetarian children, total vegetarian children, even have an edge over children who are non-vegetarians. Now, another problem area that total vegetarians are often considered to be deficient in is that of calcium. When we first began to consider a total vegetarian diet, my husband and I, both being physicians, were very concerned about our children. We had two children at the time who were less than 10 years of age. In fact, they were less than 8. And we felt that they were the most precious things that we had custody over in this world, and that our obligations and responsibilities here were of such a nature that we should not make a step that we could not be certain of. So one of the things that we investigated was that of calcium. And in our book, Nutrition for Vegetarians, we have on page 73 a table in which we compare various common foods for their calcium content. Cow's milk has a calcium content in one cup of 288 milligrams. One cup of breast milk, by contrast, has only 80 milligrams of calcium. This immediately alerts us to the fact that baby humans need far less in the way of calcium than do baby calves. And the divine designer who designed both of them put the specific quantity of calcium that each species would need, and the milk is as specific as the fingerprint is for the species. And so with the calcium content of milk being just a fraction of that of cow's milk, breast milk being a fraction of that of cow's milk, that was our first tip-off that perhaps we were on the right track so far as calcium was concerned. Then a study of the metabolism of calcium is also revealing. The adult will only take up 30% of the calcium in our food under ordinary circumstances. If, however, we have a greater need, let's say we injure a bone, we break a finger bone, we might take up 32% of the calcium in our food for a few weeks. If we break both thigh bones, the largest bones in the body, we might take up 45% of the calcium in our food. A pregnant woman might take up 50%, and if she breaks both leg bones, she might take up 65%. The same thing with a lactating woman. So the body has built into it a mechanism for the adjustment of these things, designed into us so that we would not have to put our attention on these mundane things, but could use the brain for much more noble pursuits. This kind of thing nerved us to begin a systematic investigation of various foods. And as you investigate various foods, you find that there are many common foods, those that are a part of what we eat every day, that are quite adequate, if not superlative, in their calcium content. Take a cup of broccoli. Now let's keep as our standard that of cow's milk, 288 milligrams per cup. One cup of broccoli has 392 milligrams of calcium in it. One cup of lamb's quarters, this is a little wild greens that grows in everybody's garden, everywhere all over the world that I've ever been, I've seen lamb's quarters growing. It's a very common little greens, and you can pick the tender buds and steam it lightly, and it's very much like spinach. You can use them in a green salad. Just break the little leaves in pieces. They have a beautiful little heart-shaped leaf, and they are very pretty in salads, and they increase the calcium content, since the calcium content of lamb's quarters is 516 milligrams of calcium per cup. Do you eat okra here? Some say yes, some say no. Okra has about 149 milligrams of calcium per cup. 2 tablespoons full of sesame seed has as much calcium as a whole cup of milk. 1 cup of garbanzos, which we were served for supper, has as much calcium, has more calcium, has 300 milligrams of calcium per cup. Most common legumes are high in calcium. Lentils have more calcium per cup than a cup of milk. So you can see that we can readily obtain all the calcium that we need. Where does a cow get her calcium, do you know? From greens, whole grains, and legumes. So if you would like to have the source that the cow uses, use those, and you shouldn't go wrong. John Harvey Kellogg, who lived and died not very far from here in Battle Creek, when he was living, he was a vegetarian. He was, I believe, he was an ovo-lacto vegetarian. He said, if you want to be as strong as an ox, eat what the ox eats. Don't eat the ox. And that sounds like good counsel to me. Now I have a couple of questions which I just have time for, and I will answer these, and then I would like for us to stand for a moment before our next speaker comes on. Are the wild-grown mushrooms which receive sunlight have the same no-no effect as the commercial ones, or are they all a no-no? On that point, I'm not clear, but a Dr. Bela Toth was the one who did this work in the beginning. He published his work about 12 or 15 years ago, and those of you who have access to a medical library can just look up his name for several years ago, about 10 or 12 years ago, and you will find a good bit of work. He published not just one article, but several in the medical literature, and you can find in the Index Medicus or the current list a listing for Bela, B-E-L-A, Toth, T-O-T-H. He did the first work along this line. He found that 2 of the 3 commercially grown mushrooms in this country do contain hydrazine, which is the cancer-producing agent. Benzene diazonium is a related compound, and it has been found also in mushrooms as they are grown. Whether this occurs in the wild mushrooms, I'm not certain whether tests have been done on them. Doubtless they have, but if so, I'm just unfamiliar with that research. Here is a question. What can be used to relieve pain instead of Tylenol in treating cancer? Cancer in the lymph glands and other places, and one that might be growing outwardly and causing pain in the leg. Here is a list of some of the things that you should do. Maybe before I discuss the list of things to do, I probably should tell you why you should not use Tylenol. Tylenol is known to damage the liver, can cause tumors of the liver and hepatitis, and in the unborn child can cause a failure of proper development of the liver so that the various portions of the liver fail to make a proper connection. And it can be quite a devastating problem for the unborn child. Aspirin should not be used because of its interference in the prostaglandin system, its interference with the nervous system and the transmission of impulses in the central nervous system, because of its interference in our clotting mechanism and a variety of other places where it interferes with the body's metabolism, illustrating that it is a toxic substance for the human body. Number one in the list of things to do for pain is that of heat. Try that. Often it relieves pain. Use heating pads or hot water bottles. And sometimes one will do better than another. The heating pad will sometimes do quite well. But at other times, a hot water bottle filled not entirely full can be just the thing that will be helpful. Why it is that one helps at one time and another at another time, I'm not entirely certain. It may have to do with such things as pressure or maybe it's the thing that I'm hoping that we might hear some more about a little later from Dr. Callahan on this thing of frequency. I was very happy to hear this very nice scientific treatise on some of these things that appear sometimes to be a little bit of voodoo and are not at all. They're very nicely scientifically based. Then another thing is that of heat, of cold. Heat can help, but sometimes cold is the very thing to use. Try that as your second line of defense against pain. Then manipulation can be helpful. Now, here you need to be a little bit wise. If your pain is in the shoulder, if you have a manipulation of the feet or a manipulation of the opposite shoulder, it can often be as effective as working directly on the place where you have the pain. And since it is often the case that the person who has cancer would greatly prefer that you not manipulate that, then it may be better to work in some distant area. I find that a foot rub the manipulation of the feet with a full range of motion can be very helpful. The manipulation of the spine, just even such a thing as a rocking motion can be very helpful for an individual who has pain. To give you that simple technique, have the person who has pain lie prone on a bed, that is face down. Then with one hand, and let's say the head is down, head is to your left, then with your right hand on the hip, just set up a rocking motion with the heel of your hand. And with the other hand, just with every other rock that you give, just press down someplace and move your hand on the chest back and forth as you do the rocking. And give a good little rocking motion so that the spine has a good bit of relaxation by the rocking motion that you do. This can be very relaxing and pain-relieving to many people. Exercise is very good. Exercise the part if you can. If they have pain in the neck, then exercise the neck. And a very good exercise for the neck, for pain anywhere in the back and neck, is this simple one, and I'd like for you to do it with me. Take the heel of your hand and put it on your forehead. press as hard as you can until you get a little tremor. When you get a little tremor, hold it for 5 seconds. Then release it and do the same thing on the side. Press until you get a tremor and hold it for 5 seconds. Then the same thing on the opposite side. Press till you get a tremor and hold it for 5 seconds. And one of the hardest ones to get a tremor is back here. But lock your hands behind your head and then press your head into your hands until you get a tremor and hold it for 5 seconds. Do this once or twice or three times in one series, and do the series 3 to 5 times a day. And it can be very helpful for pain. Now about three more things. Being out of doors many hours per day can help you much if you have pain. If you have a patient who has pain, you will find that they complain much less with pain if they simply sit outdoors instead of sitting indoors, or if you put a hammock out of doors instead of indoors. It may have to do with a negative ion, and maybe someday we'll know more about that. Drinking water, such as one glass full every 10 minutes for an hour, can be helpful to relieve pain. A full body massage, or a foot massage, or hand massage, or scalp massage can also be very helpful. And if all other remedies for pain fail, we can usually get some good results from doing an enema. I think it has to do with the gait theory of pain, where only certain nerve impulses are allowed to go through. And if we do an enema, we do send quite a barrage of impulses up to the central nervous system, and that could interfere with the receipt of pain impulses. I hope this has been of some help, and that those who would like to treat pain without using toxic drugs will learn how to do so with these things.
Been listening to Dr. Agatha Thrash speaking at the 1985 Michigan Organic State Fair Harvest Festival. International copyright 1985 American Cassette Ministries. All rights reserved. This cassette is protected by international copyright and thus protected against copying, duplication, and transcription. Please understand it is illegal to copy this cassette. For additional copies of this cassette, as well as our latest gift catalog, please write to American Cassette Ministries. Our address is Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Our postal zip code is 17108 in the United States of America. Waiting to serve you, this is American Cassette Ministries. We're a nonprofit corporation helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ.